Welcome to the Sharedcare Scotland podcast. You're listening to a talk given as part of the Creative Break conference series recorded on the 16th of November 2011. This talk is given by Rob Gregg, Chief Executive of the National Development Team for Inclusion, and is on promoting creativity, valued short breaks and effective co-production.
Thank you very much for that build-up, which I've now got to live up to somehow. It is a real pleasure to be here and to have the chance to share with you about some of the learning that we've been doing around short breaks for disabled children. This, I'm going to particularly talk about some work that we've done in England, where short breaks are organised, funded, and policy is done on a silo basis between children and adults and so on. But I think that a lot of what I'm going to talk about is directly applicable to short breaks generally. A little bit about the National Development Team for Inclusion that I head up. It's been going for about 30 years, and I'm obviously very conscious that there's connotations about the word national in that name. We work across all four countries of the United Kingdom. Some of our work in Scotland we do in partnership with an organisation called Outside the Box that I guess a number of you will know about. We're developing a new relationship with them. Our interest is about people who are excluded from society because of disability or age, and ensuring that they get real chances and opportunities to be equal citizens in their communities. And we do that through everything from national policy work, research and evaluation, working at the front line with people and organisations to make a difference. That's a little bit about us and what we do. Now, one of the things that we were asked to do a couple of years ago was to do an evaluation of the English government's initiative around short breaks for disabled children. There are some similarities to what's taking place in Scotland, but also quite a few differences as well, and those differences I think are quite important. There's some stuff on the screen there to explain it. I won't go through it all, but in short, every local authority, and this was channeled through local authorities in partnership with the NHS, every local authority was given money to improve and develop short breaks for disabled children. And 21 authorities were given that money a couple of years early and given some extra money to pilot and try out new ways of doing things. So ourselves, in partnership with the Centre for Disability Research at Lancaster University, were asked to evaluate whether the way those pathfinders worked and the things that they did had an impact and led to better short breaks and better outcomes. I won't go through the full detail of how we did it, because this isn't an academic conference, but we used an approach called realist evaluation, because we kind of don't think that the sort of research where researchers descend, ask lots of questions, go away and produce a report is a particularly helpful sort of research. We also don't think the sort of research that actually tells you whether something's happened or not is helpful research. We think that research should actually be participative and also help to explain why things happened. So if something did or didn't work, what was it that was going on that made it work or not work? Because only if you know that can you then actually go and replicate that learning in a different place. I hope I've made sense in the way I've explained that. So again, I won't go through this, but this is the rough process we used. We a two-phase piece of work. We met all stakeholders in all the different pathfinders. We produced some initial ideas. We went back to the local stakeholders and says, this is what we think we found out. Does it make sense to you? Does the rationale make sense? Out of that, we revised that. We did check a load of case studies with individuals to make sure that our conclusions were making sense in the real lives of real people as opposed to just a theoretical thing, and then produce the final report. At the end of this, I'll put up the website you can get the details from. There's a report, there's a two-page summary of it, and there are now a series of briefings for local government and others on how to make use of our findings which we've produced. So that's a bit about it. Let me therefore go on and talk about the things that we found, because what I want to try and do is draw out some of the learning that might be helpful to you in your journey about improving short breaks generally. We came up with a number of particular conclusions, things where the evidence very clearly showed if you did things in a particular way, then short breaks were going to be delivered more effectively. The first and most clear conclusion, and I'm going to come back to this for the last few minutes of my presentation, was about parental participation. Bearing in mind this was disabled children, so with this focus on parental participation. I'll come back to participation of young people themselves in a few minutes. But there is absolutely no doubt that where families and parents were actively involved from the outset in planning how short breaks were going to be developed in an area, that the outcomes were better. There was no doubt about that at all. Outcomes in terms of people's satisfaction, outcomes in terms of the range and type and style of short breaks. But it's important to say that those places that just tried to, you know, bolt on family participation at the side and say we're doing it, that didn't have the effect. It's a process, places where there was a history of developing that parental involvement, it worked much more effectively. And also a recognition that you don't have one way of involving families. You have to do it in a range of different ways that meet the differing needs, positions, wishes and aspirations of families. So you have to have a range of different techniques, different ways of involving parents and families in doing that. And crucially, that there has to be a reason for their involvement, which is usually coming back to their son, daughter's family member's particular position. You know, just involving people saying, come to this meeting, please, we'd like to consult some families, is not going to be a very constructive way of involving families. There has to be some real outcome, some output that benefits families as well. The other thing that we thought was very interesting around this was that what was really crucial to the success was what we called visionary local authority officers. That leadership that we just heard being talked about, you know, people who can do, was absolutely essential to this. And that the best progress was where there was a partnership between local authority leadership that believed genuinely in family involvement and families who were supported in a range of ways to get involved. And where that was happening, short breaks improved significantly. Worth noting some of the lack of progress, what we call seldom heard families, families who tend to be excluded from the process, from minority ethnic communities, families of people perhaps who got the greatest disabilities because they were so wrapped up in their family lives. Little progress in involving those things. And it's worth pointing out that even where there was really good progress, it was still only a handful of families that were being involved. You know, the vast majority of families remain not involved in the developing work around short breaks. But I just want to emphasise that area particularly. That was so crucial. Family involvement is at the centre of this. The second conclusion was quite an interesting one, really. There was loads of kind of government documents about short breaks, but actually they weren't very clear about what a short break is. You know, when is a short break not a short break? And what we found was that that lack of clarity was really helpful in the places where there were creative, visionary, local authority leadership, because they used that lack of clarity to do stuff that was really different and innovative. On the other hand, where there were the naysayers in local authorities, they used it as an excuse to say, oh, we can't do that because it doesn't say we can do that in the policy. So the lack of clarity is great if you've got innovative local people and a positive hindrance if you've got local people who don't want to do anything. And that's a bit of a conundrum, isn't it? So what do you do from a governmental level in terms of wanting to encourage changes? Families were very unaware, therefore, of what they actually might expect from a short break because there wasn't clarity around what a short break was. So they didn't know when to ask for something and what they could ask for. And it required that innovative thinking from people to say, it doesn't matter what it is, if it helps you and your son or daughter have a better life and get a break, then it's a short break. Our favourite story of the whole lot was about this young mother whose young daughter was with her every minute of the day, and she got no break at all. And one of the little things, it's a very little example, but it's great, one of the little things that they used the short break funding for was to buy the daughter a tricycle. Because what that meant was that the mother could go to the park with her friends, and her daughter could cycle off to the other side of the park. She could still see her, knew she was okay, but she got 10 minutes to chat with a friend. For her, that was the ideal short break. Yeah? And her daughter, when we chatted to her, said, I love my bike loads, which is just a lovely comment on a really good short break, completely different to the big stuff that is really important, the week-long breaks and so on. But it required creativity for that to be used as a short break. But this kind of lack of clarity was leading to real geographical variations in terms of short breaks were going, and that's clearly a governmental challenge. There was also a particular problem. I don't know how much you're experiencing this in terms of the role of the NHS. I'll come back to that again in a minute, because this was supposed to be jointly in partnership with the NHS as well. And most of the NHS was having real difficulty in understanding what their role in short breaks were. You know, there was still the struggle to understand what is the health short break. Well, I don't think there is such a thing as a health short break. The important thing is that the health service needs to understand how how to contribute health support to short breaks so that people can have it as an holistic package of support. And that was another area where policy wasn't particularly helpful. Our third set of conclusions was around the definition of inclusion and ordinariness. Now, as I've said, and as you can guess from our name, we've got a particular interest in community inclusion as an agenda. So, you know, I have to admit, you know, impartial research, etc., we come into this with a bit of a personal bias that we think inclusion is a good thing. So actually, you know, it hit us slightly to find that the most popular short breaks were actually those which involved disabled young people being together collectively, but in an inclusive setting. And that many of the short breaks, which involved opening up fully inclusive community opportunities, were not, and we chose our words carefully here, did not result in disabled young people feeling that they belonged and were cherished in those places. Yeah? So there was something about getting away from segregation, but actually still giving people the opportunity to come together in a mainstream setting. But it's also worth emphasising, in the very small number of places that had really successfully progressed the fully inclusive opportunities, those were the most valued and positively viewed experiences. So there is something about inclusion being a journey that people have to be supported on, rather than something people can just be pushed into straight away. When people get to that fully inclusive short break, fully mainstreamed opportunity, it is what people valued more than anything else. But if people were pushed and went there too soon, then it could potentially go wrong. We also saw, when we got to those more mainstream inclusive opportunities, that there were clear benefits that I'll come back to in a second, in terms of the attitude and behaviour of what you call the mainstream services, the youth services, the education services, the play schemes, the community opportunities. But that only happened where there was serious planning and looking at things like workforce development and opportunities. Our fourth conclusion, and one I in some ways enjoyed most, was the one around commissioning. I say this as somebody who in my past used to manage services in both the local government and the NHS. Because what was clearly happening was that, for the most part, local authority commissioning processes were an obstacle to the development of good creative short breaks. Put at its most simplistic, a lot of the best opportunities were being developed by family-led local organisations, who, when they found themselves faced with a 50-page tender document and a 6-month process to be able to get a couple of £1,000 out of the local authority, gave up. And so the money went to the old traditional stuff that was boring and people didn't want. Commissioners need to understand their local communities and find new ways that get beyond the traditional contract and tendering processes to enable some opportunities to be in place that otherwise wouldn't be there. And that includes getting away from only dealing with specialist short break disability providers and actually encouraging mainstream voluntary and community organisations to provide opportunities for young people with disabilities. And one of the most worrying things for us about the commissioning thing was there was an almost complete absence of any outcomes evidence. So the local authorities that were commissioning these services were unable to produce us any evidence to say whether or not the services had resulted in better outcomes for people. Which begs to me the question of how were they therefore commissioning services if they didn't know whether they were working or not. There were a couple of examples that were, but on the whole, that was a major problem. Our fifth conclusion, fairly straightforward, I don't think I need to spend too much time on this, on the question of partnership working, where different agencies working together, clearly those places were making much better progress than those that didn't have the history of that particular partnership. What was interesting, obviously, was the partnership with wider authorities outside the health and social care and education arenas, but actually getting into the leisure, the employment arenas for teenagers beginning to look at genuine work experience, and most crucially, that partnership that I've mentioned with families, seeing families as full partners and not seeing partnership working as purely something that the statutory sectors and the service provider sectors actually did together. There was a particular question we were asked to look at in terms of access and equity, because part of the policy drive in England was around the fact that there was a perception that, you know, a lot of the money was spent on a small number of people, and some people, particularly some of the people with more complex needs, some young people with autism and so on, were not getting access to short breaks. One of the ways in which that was overcome was by a lot of authorities introducing what they called an entitlement model. Essentially, if you got particular disability benefits, you were automatically entitled to a given amount of short break time resource, whatever. You didn't have to go through an assessment process. And that was working, and it was increasing the number of people getting breaks, but only those who had the lowest level of need. What then happened, if you had a higher level of need, you went into a second tier of assessment, and it was almost as though the local authorities, to make up for giving money for nothing in the first bit, doubled the complexity of the assessment with more complex needs, and it became incredibly bureaucratic. So there were problems with that that was happening, but it seemed that what was most important about getting people services was actually information, and information to families. In part, going back to my earlier point about what is a short break, but families being supported to know what they could get access to was the greatest indicator of the potential for increasing the range of people who were getting services and support. We could find no real evidence that some of these people with more complex needs had actually got greater breaks as a consequence of this. And I think there's lessons there about centrally directed policies not necessarily working, although we actually think that that was in part because the data collection was so weak that you couldn't really work out whether people were getting more services or not. Back on an earlier theme, limited initiatives on some of the more excluded people, like people from minority ethnic communities, which was disappointing. We had real difficulty in finding progress there. The final one of our conclusions, at least I think it's the final one, I hope I got that right, and this is a really interesting one from a governmental perspective, was that about accountability and resource protection, because this initiative had money that was ring-fenced in local authority terms. You know, ring-fencing is generally a dirty word in government nowadays, but it was ring-fenced. And there had to be nationally reporting from each local authority on how it was being used, progress, etc. It was absolutely clear, without a shadow of a doubt, that without that ring fencing and without that national reporting, the progress would not have been made. The money would have been shoved in a back pocket and spent on something different. And that's a tough message for governments who believe in not ring fencing things. But without it, the policy wouldn't have been delivered. And one part of that evidence was that in England, it was ring-fenced and reported required in the local authorities, but not in the NHS. Local authorities spent the money, NHS didn't. Local authorities got involved, NHS didn't. So if you want the policy to happen, you have to do a degree of that central direction and control. One of the things that quite interested us as well was that many local authorities reported that the fact they had got this ring-fenced money was a wonderful carrot to encourage the mainstream services to get involved. You know, so the local leisure centre would say, oh, well, if you're bringing this bit of money, then we'll chuck in some of our money as well to improve services for disabled kids in a way they had never done before. So it's a way of actually levering resources out of mainstream services. There were a couple of other things that we've only described as tentative conclusions because we didn't get any real evidence. One of those is about participation of children and young people. You know, it would have been nice if we'd been able to say that the involvement of children and young people was clearly improving short breaks, but we couldn't say that with certainty. There was some tentative evidence around it, but that was mainly because initiatives were in early days around this. And they were largely in early days because of the significant proportion of local authority officers and indeed family members who didn't believe that disabled young people could get involved in determining the direction of their short break services. There's a belief system challenge still out there that needs to be addressed. The other tentative conclusion was about, is this sustainable? One of the policy objectives was to increase the extent to which mainstream resources were being inclusive of disabled young people. And the question is that going to continue once this ring-fence money disappears? As it is doing now. And we began to see some indications that maybe that would happen, but we couldn't definitively say it would. So I think there's something about understanding that you need quite a long lead-in period to change the behaviour of mainstream services, even though we know that some changes are beginning to happen. So there's some very clear learning. Parental involvement and investment in co-production that I'm going to come on to for my last few minutes are essential parts about improving services and outcomes. Inclusion is a journey that people need to be supported on. Direct payments, I haven't explicitly mentioned, that was one of the things that we looked at. Direct payments with the right support were clearly a powerful tool for improving short breaks. But if families were not supported to use those direct payments effectively, then they were perceived as a burden and had a negative input. So there's something about not just giving people the money and saying, there you are, get on with it. There's something about supporting people effectively. And of course, commissioning techniques, as I've talked about, have to change. Some very clear learning from that. And as I've said, there's some interesting conclusions for the government in England in the case of this research. You know, this point about if a lack of national direction increases the postcode lottery, the best get better, the weakest stay put. So how do you overcome that? If you don't ring fence monies, then it'll be spent on something else. This is one that I haven't mentioned so far, but at a time when resources are constrained, one of the first things that happened is that local authority cut management tiers. Those places who did not invest in management dedicated to improving short breaks made no progress. Now, we couldn't say that if you invested in management and planning, your breaks improved. It wasn't that simple, because some people did that and it didn't work because they didn't do all the other things I was talking about. But what was clear is if you didn't invest in dedicated management and planning time to improve short breaks, they would not improve. So at a time when we're all cutting back on management tiers because of financial constraints, there's a distinct negative effect of doing that if you don't make those decisions sensibly and wisely. And finally, as I've said, giving families power without information and support can be a negative experience. They must be given that power, but then you need to actually support them in using it wisely. I was asked to, and more than happy, to finish with a few words on this concept of co-production. Working with disabled people, older people, and others to ensure they are determining the direction of services and support. And as was mentioned in my introduction, I, for a number of years, led the Valuing People policy in England. That's the English policy around the lives of people learning disabilities. And it was people learning disabilities themselves who came up with the phrase of nothing about us without us, which has become a bit of a mantra in England. I know there's versions of that being used in Scotland with the same as you work. And it's interesting in England that that phrase has now been pinched by the Secretary of State for Health in the new NHS reforms. No decision about me without me is his mantra. He has no idea where it's come from. And one of these days, if I ever get to meet the man, I must tell him where it came from. But it came from people with learning disabilities. What's co-production? It's an idea that's come from disabled people. The concept being, you know, people are recognised as experts in setting their own support needs. They have things to contribute to planning and decision making involved in the from the outset in a partnership, and the ideas are built into the whole organisation and planning system. So it's being involved all the way through about everything. Now, some of you, I'm sure, will say, well, what's new about that? We've been doing that for a number of years. And one of the problems I find in this area that we all work in is that we often think we've been doing things for a number of years until we reflect on whether we've really been doing these things for a number of years. So I think this is quite a helpful analogy. I don't know if there's anybody in the room who is either a personnel human resources expert or a trade union leader or whatever, but you might recognise this framework that I'm using, which is an industrial relations framework for trade union recognition, that when you get negotiations around trade union recognition about the level of involvement, there are different tiers. Now, I think we can apply this to the involvement of disabled people and older people and others in decision-making in organisations. Level one is information. So I'm going to do this in industrial relations terms now, right? Which is that we, the managers, tell you what we're going to do, right? That's recognised as level one. As I say them in industrial relations term, I ask you to reflect on how your organisation or the organisations you work with do this in relation to the involvement of disabled and other people in decision making. The second level is communication, which is that we tell people what we're doing, but then we listen to them. And if they make a really good case, then maybe we'll change a bit, probably at the margins, in order to make a pretense that we've listened and changed something. Excuse my cynicism. The third level is consultation, which is that we discuss what we intend doing before we decide to do it, but at the end of the day, we, the managers, have the right to decide what's going to happen. Yep. So we'll listen to people, we'll change a few things, but at the end of the day, it's our shot. The fourth one is negotiation, which is that both parties have to be happy at the end of the day with what's decided. Right? Now, co-production is negotiation, possibly consultation. It's about people being involved and actually having direct involvement and influence and control over the decisions that are taken at the end of the day. And I'm not sure that that's what we generally do in services. And of course, the question nowadays is there a fifth one, which is about handing over control. You know, why do we need to stop at equal control between people who run services and people who use services? Shouldn't we actually be handing power over? So co-production is about getting towards the bottom level of that list there, which I suspect is what we haven't really been doing. We also then need to think about co-production where at different levels, and I've identified four different levels at which co-production is important. The first is in people's own lives. You know, effective person-centred planning, that means that people's overall hopes and day-to-day decisions are genuinely driven by them. The second level is about organisational decision-making. So how is our organisation using co-production as a way to determine and decide how we actually deliver services? Or if you're a local authority, develop at the next level strategic decision making at local, national, regional, whatever the level is, how are we involving people at those particular levels? And finally, beyond services, what about co-production in the person's own community? How are disabled people and older people getting involved in decisions in their local community beyond services so that the voice of disabled people is being listened to effectively? So we need to think about co-production in those different contexts as well. We did some work with older people for the Department of Health in England to develop principles around co-production. And we identified these seven principles, which are people involved throughout, people feel safe to speak up and are listened to, so you need to create an environment, an effective environment, whereby people feel confident to be partners in co-production. That the issues that we work on are the issues that people say are important to them, not the issue that services and managers have decided should be important to people. Fourthly, co-production requires clarity about how decisions are being made. So it's understood how, where, and why decisions are being made, so there isn't discussion and debate, and then somebody goes into the ubiquitous smoke-filled room, the decision is taken without disabled people's involvement, or older people in this case. Fifthly, people's skills and experiences are used in the process of change, because people will bring to that table different skills, different ways of doing things to the ways in which managers and planners would traditionally operate. So use that expertise effectively and wisely as an additional resource. Sixthly, that meetings, materials and venues are accessible so that people can genuinely get involved. And finally, that progress is evaluated by looking at outcomes. Has it resulted in people's lives changing or not? Now, those are the things that older people told us, if you did those, then they think it would be genuine co-production. But I just want to flag up, just before I finish, about some of the pitfalls that I think we all step into in doing what we might call co-production, things that I've seen, and if I'm being honest, things that I have been party to in the past as well. Tokenism, you know, one person sitting at a table with a dozen managers is the classic thing that we do, as opposed to genuine power sharing. From a learning disability perspective, the production of easy read materials that tell people nothing. You know, lots of nice pictures and simple words, but actually when you read it, it bears little relationship to the original document that's supposed to be the easy read version of and doesn't really tell people what's in the substantial document. Poor quality advocacy support. No offence meant to 19-year-old young people. I've got a son who's a 19-year-old young person. But the frequency with which I've seen learning disabled people supported at local authority planning meetings, talking about complex issues with young supporters who don't understand the context of what's going on in the meeting themselves anyway, so how the hell can they actually support that person in those decision makings, is very frustrating. So we need to ensure we invest in proper support for advocacy for co-production. Only involving people in the small matters, not the big things. Expecting people to be able to do anything just because of their label. So someone has a disability, therefore they should be able to talk about anything. Well, we all have our areas of expertise. Make sure people are being allowed and able to involve in the things that they know about. Not working with people with the most complex needs and not realising almost everything affects people with disabilities. One of my big arguments and minor successes in my days of working at the Department of Health was actually when I finally got them to understand they didn't need to produce easy read versions of just learning disability policy, because actually cancer policy, heart policy, organisational restructuring affected learning disabled people as well, so they needed easy read versions of that so people could participate. Finally, practical steps to get started on COPRA. Here's some ideas for you that you might want to do in your organisations. Make a commitment to nothing about us without us. As an organisation, say we're going to do that if we haven't already. Build a group to champion this work with families, disabled people and others at the centre of that. Define what co-production means for your organisation. How are you going to do it? Maybe building on those principles that I shared with you. Invest in developing self-direct support and taking time to enable people to take that power that you're offering them rather than expecting them to be able to do it immediately. develop a positive risk-taking policy, because this will involve risks that will go wrong. Review commissioning and contracting processes. That's, I said, a big learning out of that research. And think community and start building skills beyond traditional services. I would say if you're talking about co-production around effective short breaks, that's my kind of top 7, 8, however many it is, list of things to get done. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to share this learning with you. I'm going to be around all day. I have to leave, I think, just before the end. The website there, that gives you access to all the further information about the work. Thank you very much.